Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Diversity is something that every organization strives for, but there are some organizations where diversity is perhaps even more crucial, and a news organization is one. To effectively report on the events of our communities, journalists must reflect those communities, or at the very least, tap into a diverse pool of sources to help tell our stories. This hour on All Sides, we'll look at diversity in newsrooms and in news coverage. Our guest is Luis Clemens. He is NPR's senior editor for diversity. His job is to offer diversity training to journalists and help reporters and producers find that diverse pool of sources to enhance NPR's news coverage. Luis Clemens, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks very much for having me.
We welcome your calls. Do you think the news you read, see, and hear every day reflects you and your community? What can we as journalists do better? Give us a call at 292-8513, 292-8513, or send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. Luis Clemens, your appointment came right after the Juan Williams controversy, a controversy in which he pointed out that he, at the time, before his dismissal, that he was the only African-American male regularly on the air at NPR. Would NPR have named a senior editor of diversity if it were not for that controversy?
Well, that was very much in the works before that whole incident, and specifically the application process had already closed,
Okay. And
it was a done deal long before that happened, a couple months before that happened. And very much reflects an awareness within NPR that there was a need very much for greater diversity on the air, and greater diversity among staff, and greater diversity in our coverage.
So the timing was just a coincidence that it came right after the big flap.
Unfortunate coincidence, yes.
What does the senior editor of diversity do at NPR?
I do a couple things. I have three specific functions. One is talent recruitment, identifying talented journalists that qualify to work at NPR. Two, I work to increase the editorial coverage on air of different communities, specifically African American, Asian American, Native American, Latino. And lastly, what I do is try and increase the pool of experts and sources available to our reporters so that we can interview a broader range of people on our air and tap into a greater deal of information about what's going on in communities that don't get as much coverage.
Mm-hmm. What's the biggest challenge? Of all the things you listed, what is the biggest challenge that NPR faces?
Well, I'd say finding people is not the biggest challenge.
The talent recruitment is not the biggest?
Both in terms of talent recruitment or in terms of identifying sources.
Okay.
What you have as an obstacle is, look, before I came to NPR, I was covering Latino voters as part of the presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited once, and then I was invited another 20 times over the course of 12 months. What we all face is a natural instinct in newsrooms. You've got someone that works for you, you keep going back to
mm-hmm.
them. Getting someone into that pool of usual suspects, it's often a high barrier.
And a lot of times it's just logistics. You're trying to turn a story quickly, you know this person, you have their phone number, you have two phone numbers for them.
Right.
You know they'll call you back. You keep going back to that person.
It's convenience. It's
mm-hmm.
it's editorial convenience, but it's also a failure of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly we all face deadlines, but the challenge is for me to essentially find people for whom I have both their numbers,
mm-hmm.
whom I know are perfectly capable of speaking on short notice, and then when the story comes up, making sure the different people at NPR have that same information.
We're talking about diversity in newsrooms, diversity in news coverage, both at NPR, here at WOSU, and at newsrooms of all sorts all around the country. If you'd like to join our conversation, 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Our guest is Luis Clemens. He's NPR's senior editor for diversity. Do you critique stories? Do you critique programs after they've aired?
Well, I do have weekly discussions with a number of the news managers and talk about what we did, what we missed, what worked, what didn't work. And that's a weekly occurrence. I'm obviously spending a lot of my time listening to our shows on air and trying to figure out what we could do better. That is my daily obligation.
In your first 6 months on the job, assess how NPR compares to other organizations, assess how it's doing when it comes to diversity and how it's doing in these areas.
Look, I think where we have made a significant amount of improvement is in terms of our on-air reports. Obviously, we're talking about the team of correspondents at NPR as well as reporters at member stations throughout the country. And what we have is an increasing degree of interest in doing stories about some of these communities. And those stories get on the air. Mm-hmm. And that has been everything from a story yesterday or day before about the NAACP, which is a Black Civil Rights Organization, electing Latino presidents for a number of chapters, and how that's sparking a bit of a backlash in mm-hmm. some communities. That kind of story, I'm not sure we would have been as tuned into 6 months ago. So that's one concrete example of what we're doing better. What is still a challenge is when you're on deadline and there's some big news story, making sure that the pool of experts that we can turn to on short notice is more diverse.
When it comes to the staff makeup of NPR, how hard is it? We face this challenge here at WOSU. We are a very white newsroom. We have one person of color in our newsroom, and that's it. And we've had a hard time recruiting and finding people of color to work in our newsroom. How challenging is it for NPR, for organizations, to recruit people of color? And is it just an excuse we use that we can't find enough people?
There are people. There are no shortage of talented journalists who are African American, Asian American, Native American, Latino. It becomes a question of tapping into those networks. It becomes a question of deliberately seeking out qualified candidates before you have an opening. If you're starting that process only once you have a vacancy, it's over. The time frame is too short, and it's going to look like you're priming the pump, stacking the pool, all the sorts of things that you really don't want to do. You want to know, okay, who are the five journalists that I really want to bombard with job offers as they come up? And that's the process that we're very much undertaking now. Mm-hmm. And the other bit is just thinking about it and being aware of it and trying to figure out how to combat it.
When you hear the names on NPR, it's Neda Ulabi, Dwali Saikauta.
Yes.
I mean, there are names that are difficult to pronounce,
yes.
Which means it's a pretty diverse reporting pool.
We have a very strange group of names on our air and unexpected combinations. And I don't know if that's something that NPR attracts these people somehow by the uniqueness of their names. But, yes, I mean, there is a very broad group of people, both in terms of on our domestic staff here in the U.S. and overseas. I think the key point that we can sell as public media is journalism. Heck, we even take our humor seriously at NPR. I mean, for our April Fool's Day joke that we did on All Things Considered, it was a rather elaborate, drawn-out production.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of that story, but it is very listenable.
And when you think about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Car Talk, I mean, we take our news, our information, our talk, even our music seriously.
292-8513, if you'd like to join in our conversation. Luis Clemens is our guest. He is NPR's senior editor for diversity. He is recently hired. He was hired last fall. And his job is to help NPR increase the diversity of its newsroom and also increase the diversity of its coverage and its sources. And also, he works with member stations around the country like WOSU. How do you work with the stations?
Well, I have done already several visits. I went to Wisconsin Public Radio in December, charming time of year to be there.
Yes.
I'm going to Amherst, Massachusetts later in the year, North Carolina later this summer, going out to L.A. and meeting with station reporters. The idea is to have routine contact with folks and literally make myself available by phone, by Twitter. I'm tapping into networks of station reporters and journalists on Twitter and offering whatever assistance I can. And oftentimes that's as simple as suggesting a name for a given story.
How different is it trying to help an NPR reporter with this issue of finding diverse sources? And compare that to a reporter in a, not necessarily a big city, but in a small city around
Look,
the country.
There are, if you're at a local station and let's say you have the largest minority group in your community is Hispanic. Well, that's where you concentrate offers, your efforts in terms of trying to get new sources in that community. If you're somewhere where the largest minority community is Cambodian, well, that's where you go. Whereas at NPR, you know, I can pick and choose people from all over the country. You're generally looking for people in your state or at most in the region. Mm-hmm. And obviously that narrows the field. But, you know, what the census has shown clearly is that the degree of diversity across the country is growing by leaps and bounds.
292-8513, or give us a ring on all sides, or drop us a line on all sides at WOSU.org. Prior to working at NPR, you worked at NBC television stations in Miami. You worked at CNN as an assignment editor. How have newsrooms changed with regards to diversity over those years of your
career?
That's funny.
I've been a journalist now for 20 years. It's always odd when you get to that point in your life when you can say you've done anything for 20 years.
I know. You've been working longer than you were in school.
And, you know, I started off in Miami. I started off in I worked in both the Spanish language newsroom at a local Spanish language channel, as well as NBC, an English language, language operation. And there was awareness, there was interest, but there was not the same sort of drive. You're talking about changes in pop culture. You're talking about changes in who lives next to you, who you see in the pew across the way at church, who you run into the shopping center, who's married into your family. Mm-hmm. It's become a much more urgent issue. The pockets of the country where you have no contact with folks of different races and ethnicities, well, they're fewer and farther between.
How about the makeup of the newsroom?
The makeup of the newsroom in a place like Miami, when I was there, was pretty darn diverse. Mm-hmm. This was a place that had experienced, especially in Miami, a great deal of racial tension and had seen successive waves of immigrants. So there was a conscious decision at really all the local television stations that an awareness that they were competing with specialized media. And what I mean by that there were, you know, Spanish language stations where everyone on camera was Hispanic.
How about at CNN?
At CNN, when I was there, it was I started working for CNN's Spanish language service, but you know, you left the confines of that service, and there weren't a huge number of Latinos on air. I'm here this week for the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Journalism at John Glenn School, and there are two colleagues from CNN. One is black, one is Asian. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure that would have been the case when I was there 10 years ago.
The coverage and the stories that these newsrooms pick, I mean, I'm talking mainly not the Hispanic channels that focus mainly on the Spanish-speaking community, but, you know, CNN and the main television station in Miami. How has the story coverage changed? How has the coverage of diverse cultures, minority populations changed in those 20 years?
Look, I think you have to give credit to CNN when you see their on-air staff for the U.S. program. It's now very different than it was 10 years ago. It's much more diverse. And you see that also in terms of story selection. I think of the coverage that CNN gave of the Bishop Eddie Long accusations in Atlanta. This is a pastor that was accused of inappropriate contact with a group of young men, and he leads a black megachurch. That's not a story that I think would have gotten as covered as widely as beforehand. Mm-hmm. And you see those changes, and it's got to be driven not only by the people who are on air, but the people who are making some of those editorial decisions in the first place.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're talking with Luis Clemens. He's NPR's senior editor for diversity. We're talking about NPR's efforts to increase diversity of its staff and its news coverage. And when we return, we'll talk about news coverage in general and how we can do a better job as journalists to reflect all communities in Central Ohio and around the country. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Listen to 89.7 NPR News anywhere, anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Live link on the left-hand side of the page. Listen to local and national news programming online anytime at WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Juan and John April 7th through the 10th. Solo performer Roger Guenver Smith brings to life the story of two baseball legends' violent encounter at home plate in 1965. More at wexarts.org.
49 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a high of 63. It's going to be windy as well, with wind gusts of up to 30 miles per hour. Cloudy tonight, a low of 47 degrees, clouds for Thursday, and a high of 65. Rain moves into the area Thursday night, and a low of 52. All Sides with Ann Fisher, with guest host Mike Thompson, continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Our guest is Louise Clemens, NPR's senior editor for diversity. We're talking about diversity in newsrooms and diversity in news coverage. Louise, do you have to be a member of a minority community to effectively cover that community?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And in fact, folks assume too often that if you are African American, you have an easy in covering an African-American community, or if you are Asian-American, that by default you speak Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Thai, etc., etc. No, definitely not. What you have to do is you have to listen and you have to respond. You have to listen, respond, and you have to be willing to feel awkward. You have to embrace the notion that, yes, you may be the only person of your race or ethnicity in a given room, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to happen to you.
One of my favorite, I use it often, and I tell our reporters here, never be afraid to tell your source that this, use the phrase, forgive my ignorance here. Tell me how it works. And I think that helps, especially when dealing with a culture that's not your own.
Absolutely. And you know what? People are very forgiving of ignorance as long as there is interest, as long as there is a genuine search for information, and a genuine willingness to figure out what is true, what is perception.
But there is an advantage of coming from a background that matches the community that you're covering on that particular day. Whether you're an African American, you can relate, you know firsthand what this person has gone through.
In some cases, let's use the example of, say, a reporter who's the child of Korean immigrants. Well, first off, they may not actually speak Korean fluently. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not going to do them any good if they're covering a Hmong community. Mm-hmm. In terms of language. In terms of sharing the immigrant experience, yes. I mean, we all bring our experiences to bear, and yes, some people will have a lead. Does that mean they'll necessarily produce better stories? Not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. 292-8513 is the number to call to talk with Louise Clemens, NPR's senior editor for diversity. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I wonder if NPR's definition of diversity includes only ethnic groups or other underrepresented groups, such as the elderly, for example. Can they be included? And I guess I bring this up in the context, apparently this week we've opened a big new national budget debate on Medicare and Medicaid, and usual NPR sources are kind of budget-cutting organizations, and I really don't hear from women who've cared for parents and, you know, found how wonderful good care can be.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thanks for the call.
A couple of things that are worth noting. In terms of the focus of my work, I really do emphasize African-Americans, Asian-Americans, Native Americans, Latinos, for a very simple reason. That's where after we made an evaluation, we realized we were coming up short. And in terms of what we do and what we don't do and where folks hear shortcomings, I really encourage everyone to contact our ombudsman. Folks can contact me as well if they like and they feel there's something that's not being covered. My email address is lclemens, that's L-C-L-E-M-E-N-S, at npr.org. Happy to hear it And as someone who helps care for an elderly father-in-law, I certainly appreciate the perspective that was just mentioned.
And that debate is just beginning, and I'm sure we'll if it continues, we'll look at those issues. But yeah, I mean, there's more than just people of color that offer diverse, that you have to focus on as far as being diversity. There's sexual orientation, there's age, there's male, female. There's more than just black, Hispanic, you know, Asian American, things like that.
That's right. And you don't, when you look at what are the assumptions, which is part of what the caller was just referring to, you know, the assumption that budget cutting is the best option. All right, that reflects a certain viewpoint, an important viewpoint, clearly, given the size of the debt, perhaps the correct one. But nonetheless, the fact is you try and pull in different viewpoints, different arguments from as broad a variety of sources, both in ideological terms as well as their own personal background.
Mm-hmm. We had an emailer who had a very similar question. He or she asked, I'm not sure if it's a man or a woman, would NPR or WOSU hire someone over 55? I can say for WOSU, yes, we would, if the person was qualified. It depends on the individual hire and the other candidates involved, but I would have no problem. Isn't 55 the new 45 now anyway? How about NPR, Luis?
Well, I can think of the executive producer of Newscast, who was a gentleman over 55 when he was hired. And, yes, I don't think that is that's an issue at NPR, I don't believe. And when you look at the age of some of our hosts, who are certainly our most prominent employees and oftentimes the best paid employees, that would seem to not have any evidence.
And unfortunately, in the journalism business right now, there are a lot of people who are 55 and over, a lot of very qualified people who are looking for work.
Absolutely.
So, there's a great pool of people out there with a lot of experience who have been cut because of economic reasons from newsrooms around the country. Terry, you're on the air with Luis Clemens from NPR.
Yes, thank you. My question revolves around the quality of reporters developing their sources. With budgets being, you know, tight in a lot of newsrooms, which you alluded to earlier, and in fact, the age question comes into play, I think. If you have turnover in a news operation, how do you verify that your candidates who are being reporters have good quality sources? Because when you watch local news here, there's a lot of turnover. They can't possibly have good sources to rely on.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call.
I would say a couple of things in terms of that. Clearly, the longer you work in journalism, mm-hmm. the bigger and the fatter your Rolodex is.
Mm-hmm.
Not that anyone actually uses an actual
Rolodex. Your contacts list anymore. On your iPhone. This is the new way to go.
No, but and you know, that's something that when I was a young journalist, I did not fully appreciate at all. I thought this is about being smart. This is about working your butt off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? More than a little gray hair, and this is self-serving as I have gray hair, is useful. And I think the way you gauge whether or not someone has sources is their actual reports. You know, their on-air reports are a daily version of their resume.
And as you gain experience, even if you are new to a market, or you know where to look for sources. You know how to network better, how to go, okay, let's go to the head of the Hispanic coalition first, and then, okay, well, he or she's going to lead you to somebody else and down the road, and then you learn to observe, say, you know, just driving around, saying, okay, this market looks like a good place to find a diverse population, that kind of thing. I think experience helps, but longevity in a market also helps, and especially in local TV, it's tough to come by sometimes.
It is, and you know, I like to talk about sourcing by eating. And what I mean by that is, you know, a journalist has got to do two things. Talk to strangers, listen to strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not really strangers if they're in the same places you go all the time. So make a point as a journalist and eat in different parts of town, and eat in restaurants you might not otherwise pop into.
292-8513. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're speaking with Louise Clemens, NPR's senior editor for diversity. We're talking about diversity in newsrooms, diversity in news coverage, how we cover communities of color and communities that are different from what the reporters live in every day. You can email us as well, allsides@wosu.org. Let's look at coverage. How do you think NPR does in covering the inner city, say, or African-American communities around the country?
Well, listen, one of the things that came out of a year-long study of a year-long process of looking at how diverse our coverage, how diverse are on our staff, how diverse our behind-the-scenes staff are, was, first off, the hiring of Vice President of Diversity, and that's Keith Woods. I had been on staff beforehand and participated in a pilot project in terms of finding new voices. That led eventually to the creation of my role. Mm-hmm. It led to the creation of the hiring of someone who is a race and ethnicity reporter, who's dedicated to covering the demographic changes in the countries on a full-time basis. How are we doing? We're doing better than we were doing 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. But it is... it's certainly more than what one person can cover, and it's also why NPR, through the range of different shows that it's involved with, whether Tell Me More with Michelle Martin, Snap Judgment, et cetera, we're trying to expand the pool of programs that tackle these issues on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Neighborhoods, in particular inner-city African-American neighborhoods, often complain that the only time they see the news media, particular television news media, is when there is a crime or something bad has happened, something that casts the neighborhood in a bad light. And there's some merit to that. How valid are their complaints, and what can we as journalists do to balance the coverage out?
You know, look, the first thing we can do is be present when there's not a crime. What was Woody Allen's line? You know, half of life is just showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a good chunk of being a journalist is just showing up and talking to people and being willing to accept being snubbed. Eventually, someone will talk to you,
mm-hmm.
and you'll have a chance to listen. In terms of the other bit of when we're talking specifically about coverage of the inner cities, I mean, we have the benefit of really relying on some 900 member stations across the country. So we're not just tapping into our staff at NPR, but we're tapping into the network of local reporters who know their communities across the country. Plus, we have a reporter who's basically dedicated full-time to covering poverty, and not poverty as some abstract discussion, but poverty as people.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, crime does occur in these neighborhoods.
Sure.
And it has to be covered.
Well, put in context, and you look in terms of, okay, what is the crime rate in a given place? How does it compare elsewhere? What is the income? What is happening in terms of police response?
Mm-hmm.
What is the degree of police presence? I mean, it's not something that at NPR we generally focus on just because, well, you know, unless there is some dramatically
national
important
trend.
National trend, it's not something that we really focus on.
And to be honest, in a local newsroom where you only have maybe a local television newsroom on any given day, let's say it has at most six reporters covering a city of a million people. Generally, what you're chasing is the crime news. You don't have the time, unfortunately, as a reporter at a local TV station or even a local radio station, to delve into those issues. You're on to your next. You have to feed the beast, as they say in the biz, and that can lead to portraying neighborhoods in an unfavorable light, perhaps unfairly.
Well, I think it depends on your definition of news.
Mm-hmm.
Is crime news? I mean, if you look at the range of the amount of times that we cover local murders when actually local murders may be down from the year before mm-hmm. or down over the last 3 years, what we're here to do is provide context. We're here to explain what is going on in people's communities with the information resources that we can tap into.
And we, I think public radio does – not to toot our own horn, but I think we do a better job than other broadcast outlets in doing that. We don't ignore crime stories here at WOSU. It's certainly news when someone is murdered, but it's not a story we're going to sensationalize. It's not a story we're going to spend a lot of time on unless we can find a wider issue or unless we can get into some of these deeper issues, which we will try to do. I assume the same holds true for NPR when you're dealing with, you know, similar type stories.
Well, very much so, in the sense that, look, if it's news, it's news. But again, at NPR, what we're trying to do is provide context, provide some sense of where this fits in overall. Otherwise, you know, it's an info scrap that's just floating in the ether.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like junk food. It fills the time, but it doesn't really say anything about your community. In fact, it might mislead your community. 292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to join us here. Our guest is Luis Clemens. He's NPR's senior editor for diversity. We're talking about diversity in newsrooms and diversity in news coverage. How much are economics driving increased diversity in newsrooms? I mean, Fox News has announced they're going to start a new Fox Hispanic Media to reach the growing Latino population in the United States. The Columbus Dispatch here locally has a Hispanic newspaper. You're hearing more and more Spanish radio stations. It's not new in some of these, in Miami certainly, but in Central Ohio, it's a fairly new phenomenon to hear Spanish voices on the radio. Economics driving diversity?
Well, economics is certainly driving the creation of outlets. Fox News, a few months ago, created a very useful site called Fox News Latino that covers the Latino community. I should point out, in terms of their Hispanic division, that they have had Spanish language cables, Fox Deportes, for their sports coverage for quite some time. Mm-hmm. This is now the fact that they're rolling it all up into one division speaks to the new prominence of it and the fact that Hispanics are growing in number and they spend money.
Does that help the overall audience understand each communities, though, or does it further segment the communities?
Well, if you're talking about an English language website like Fox News Latino, well, that's available to everyone. Mm-hmm. You do not have to speak the language. And in terms of if you look at the role of Spanish language media traditionally in the U.S., it really is one of increasing and encouraging civic participation, of getting people to register to vote, getting people to attend school board meetings, getting people to join PTAs.
The Fox tagline was Latino entertainment with an American attitude. What is the American attitude? What do you think that is, first of all?
I'm not sure. I have no idea what that means. As far as I'm concerned, the American attitude is one that reflects the full and changing nature of this country's population.
Do you think it's trying to homogenize diversity because what you're trying to do is be all things to all people. You're trying to get non-Latinos to watch. I'm guessing that's what they're trying to do.
I don't know. I can't really speak to the strategy, but it's funny. I mean, there was the discussion in the earlier hour in terms of, does this lead to some sort of homogenization or not? Right now, I think we're at the stage where people are still very interested and curious about one another, mm-hmm. and still don't know as much as we would all like to know about one another's backgrounds.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Our guest is Luis Clemens, NPR's senior editor for diversity. We're talking about diversity in news coverage, and we'll continue our discussion in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Dexter Filkins talks about the uprising in Yemen and his experiences reporting from there. Filkins' article, After the Uprising, Can Protesters Find a Path Between Dictatorship and Anarchy, is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. You can do that at WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters.
Support for 89.7 comes from Catco, presenting What the Butler Saw, a comedy by Joe Orton. on stage March 30th through April 17th in Studio One at the Rife Center. Tickets and more information at catco.org.
49 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Partly sunny skies today and windy with gusts up to 30 miles per hour. A high of 63. Cloudy skies for tonight and a low of 47. Clouds for Thursday and a high of 65 degrees. Rain showers are likely Thursday night, a low of 52. And showers and thunderstorms possible as we look ahead to Friday with a high of 69. All Science continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann Fisher today. Our guest, Louise Clemens, he's NPR's senior editor for diversity. His role at NPR is to help NPR recruit a diverse newsroom, diverse members of its newsroom, and also help it with its news coverage and making sure that they are tapping into as many sources and as diverse a pool of sources as possible. An email from Susie, she questions whether or not reporters with dual nationalities can report objectively on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And she asks, does NPR have any reporters of Palestinian descent? Do you know of?
No, I don't know of anyone, but I'd have to think about that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, I don't know many U.S. reporters who are not U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. And we certainly all feel qualified and nothing improper in terms of covering U.S. politics. Silvia Bozzoli, who is an Italian citizen, covers Italy as well as Southern Europe for us. I think our experiences, our national backgrounds often inform what we do. But in terms of, say, of my being a Roman Catholic, the extent of the influence of that in my coverage of the newsroom has been when I worked at an NPR show was to make sure that people were aware of stories that were important and breaking news about the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything. If you're a Yankees fan, you put your allegiance away and do the story. We all bring our own personal heritages and biases to a story, but we have to leave it at the newsroom door before you report on it.
But you know where it's toughest for mm-hmm. me is not when it comes to race or ethnicity or talking about journalism. It's when talking about stories. I'm a father. Mm-hmm. I have two girls. Any story that involves young kids mm-hmm. for me is very tough not to deal with personal biases. And I avoid them. Mm-hmm. Avoid them like the plague.
Louise Clemens, NPR's senior editor for diversity. We welcome your calls at 292-8513. You know, I was watching The Daily Show. It must have been about, I don't know, it was like 3 months ago. And I forget the comedian's name, who is the Muslim on the show. And they mentioned on the show that he was the only Muslim correspondent and only network Muslim correspondent in America. And I was like, you know what? He's right. But since that time, I have noticed more and more Muslim names showing up on the cable networks. Have you noticed that? And do you think the networks are making a conscious decision to try to bring that perspective to their coverage because it is such a big story?
You know, I have seen more South Asian correspondents. But you know what? I don't know what someone's religion is mm-hmm. Unless it's specifically brought up by them. I don't know. I don't know. Certainly, I can tell you, if you think about it, it makes sense if you're trying to cover a community that's in the news mm-hmm. that you have someone who is aware of that community's history and has some pre-existing context. Mm-hmm. It's what you were talking about yeah. earlier. It doesn't mean that you have to be Muslim to cover a Muslim community. Certainly, the number of religion writers who are Christian who write about Jewish synagogues and events in that community and vice versa, it's quite a lot. It's a large number.
I want to get to some specific stories. We've mentioned the Juan Williams flap, but soon after that, there was a commentary on, I think you may have already been in your position, a commentary on NPR. Daisy Hernandez was talking about, this was a commentary, clearly identified as a commentary, but she was saying she was relieved that when the name of the man accused in the Tucson, Arizona shootings came out, that it was not a Hispanic name. And here's a portion of that commentary.
It's safe to say there was a collective sigh of brown relief when the Tucson killer turned out to be a gringo. Had the shooter been Latino, Media pundits wouldn't be discussing the impact of nasty politics on a young man this week. They'd be demanding an even more stringent anti-immigrant policy.
You know, when I first heard that commentary, I was on my way home. I thought it was very excellent commentary. It just showed, you know, and I didn't have a problem with the word gringo. But there was accusations that NPR has a double standard because if just, you know, Juan Williams had been just fired for insensitive comments he made. And this is sort of like, I'm not sure it's as bad as the N-word, but it's in the same category anyway. How do you view this controversy?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first, have to be clear that I was involved in the decision to greenlight the use of the word gringo.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did so is because of what the word means in Spanish and what the context of the commentary was.
Mm-hmm.
I do not recommend our on-air reporters use it because for some it is despective.
Mm-hmm.
In Latin America, in Spanish, it is not necessarily despective. It is often descriptive, and it's used for people of a variety of races from a variety of countries. That said, lesson learned for me in this experience was that there are some words that are the equivalent of screaming fire in a crowded theater. And what it did was by alienating a whole, you know, number of people, and you saw this in hundreds of comments on our website, the point of her commentary was completely overblown by the use of the word. And you know, even though she's a commentator, she's not someone from an NPR staffer, the fact is we work with words for a living. And what we do with our words is try to communicate ideas and facts. And there are some words that just get in the way of it.
Is there a danger, though, in avoiding these words? The N-word is the one I think of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you almost never hear it, and we never use it, really. But there are cases where you hear it, and you probably should hear it, because it brings to light a certain issue, a segment of the population that uses it frequently. And we shouldn't hide the fact that there are people out there who use the word from our listeners.
I agree. Look, as journalists, we're in the business of minimizing harm mm-hmm. through our coverage, not in avoiding it. And I used to work as an editor at Tell Me More, an NPR show, and there was one instance where there was a radio host who used the word several times in on air or as part of her show, repeatedly using the N-word.
This was Dr. Lore, correct?
That's right.
Yes.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And Tell Me More decided to go ahead and air that. They made a sort of standard warning beforehand, letting people know who might be offended by it or young kids or what have you, and then they played it. And I think you can't stick your head in the sand. You can't avoid acknowledging that the word is being used and when it's used. At the same time, if you're crafting a commentary, if you're issuing a report, you're in the business of communicating, and anything that gets in the way of that, it diminishes the effectiveness of what you say.
Yeah, when I was working in one of my earlier cities, actually a good friend of my roommate, he was doing the story, and he's working for a cable news organization, and they were allowed to use one of the seven dirty words in their testimony, and it was a murder trial, and they left the F word in this witness's testimony, and it went on the air, and it was powerful, but I was so shocked that it was on the air, I did not hear the next 30 or 40 seconds of the story. And so in that case, it shouldn't have been used because I lost one-third of the story because I was just so stunned that word was in there. So that's to your point that, you know, you have to use those words carefully. Let's go to our phones. Khalid, you're on the air. Hello, Khalid. You're on the air with Louise Clemens from NPR.
Yes, sir. I was wondering why we don't have, like, foreign correspondents. Like, I listen NPR every other day and every other night, as well as BBC and CNN and sometimes AFB or something like that. So why don't we have, like, foreign correspondents? That would be better because they know. I mean, like, if we have Libyan correspondents in the uprising of Libya or Ivory Coast in the uprising of Ivory Coast, or a correspondent who is, like, maybe Jewish or Muslim correspondent in the Palestinian-Israel conflict, that would be, like, give us a good shape for NPR diversity, as well as the people in the ethnic and with the same ethnic, with the same people, they know much better than an American correspondent do.
Okay. Let's get on a response. Go ahead.
A couple things I would say to Khaled. There are correspondents that are nationals of the countries that they cover. Sylvia is one example. And then what we do have is our Jerusalem-based correspondent is a Cuban-American woman. To the point of coverage in foreign countries, I think the key thing you look for are the reporting skills and the language skills. And if you have those two, it definitely qualifies you. I'm thinking in terms of Ivory Coast, of what was mentioned. Our West Africa correspondent is based in Dakar, and she's covering the story in Ivory Coast. I don't think you ever want to get into the point of saying, okay, you will only allow nationals of that country to cover that country. Look, when you can follow the local press and you can talk to anyone in the country, It makes a huge difference.
And when you talk to NPR correspondents, even those who are based in the United States, John Burnett, who is based in Texas, was one of the first reporters in Afghanistan after 9/11. And he tells the story about what happens when he was assigned to go to Afghanistan. First of all, he grabs every book he can. And he reads them on the flight over there. As soon as he lands in Afghanistan, he gets an interpreter and what they call a fixer, someone from the area, to show them around. That's what a good foreign correspondent does. Even if they're not from that area, they make sure they know as much as they can about the history of the area, and then they find someone right away to help them cover it.
And I'll give an example. I was the CNN bureau chief in Buenos Aires for 3 years, and I spoke Spanish. I was able to easily move around in the culture. But the fact is, when you are a foreign correspondent, you notice certain things that local folks take for granted. For instance, I remember going on and on at some dinner party about the fact that the subway floors in Buenos Aires are made of wood. And folks were astounded. They didn't think that was noteworthy. But it is to an American audience. And in the end, you are speaking to an audience in the U.S. and trying to provide some sort of context that folks here can understand.
So it all goes back to sourcing again.
Yes.
Bring your experience as a reporter, your expertise as a reporter, knowing your audience, but then also making sure you have the sources who can help you tell an accurate story of that culture, of that country. Online journalism growing by leaps and bounds. It seems to me that it's dominated by white guys in their 20s and 30s. Am I wrong?
I don't know.
You think about Mark Zuckerberg and the Twitter guys.
I think offhand, some of them are no longer in their 20s.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if that's the accurate. I always think of that New Yorker cartoon on the internet. No one ever knows if you're a dog. I don't know, but certainly if you I've heard from people who have attended the big interactive media conference at South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. There are people who have been complaining about a lack of diversity among staff at startups, among editorial staff at different online journalism outfits. But it's very much new, uncharted territory, unlike newspapers in this country, unlike radio stations, unlike television stations, which provide the information, which provide the racial and ethnic breakdown of their stations, of their staff. Huffington Post, for instance, does not. AOL does not. So we're operating in a world without an awful lot of data at this point.
But you could see how, that segment of the media could make the same mistakes as other segments of the media did when they were first born.
Very much so, sure.
But on the other hand, social media does give a voice to anybody who has a smartphone or a computer, even access to a computer at a library, should they want to become a community journalist, is the term they use.
Well, and what you see is among certain demographics, you see over-indexing of use of certain social media. And translate that to English. You have black people using Twitter at a much higher rate than any other segment. You have Latinos using cell phones and smartphones at a much higher rate than any other group. So you have pockets where different races and ethnicities are more accessible than other. And I've been here this week at the Kiplinger program at the John Glenn School, and it's been an immersion in social media. Mm-hmm. And for me, the whole point of coming was to figure out, how do I use social media to find new sources, to listen and eavesdrop on conversations that are taking place now online?
Why do you think that African Americans are a large segment of the Twitter universe? Why is that, do you think?
I have no idea. I have no idea. And I mean, my experience on Twitter started a week ago with when I inscribed myself in the program, when the program started. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure it out. And I'm trying to figure out what is the motivation, because it will help me figure out how to reach new people.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out the whole Twitter thing, too. I've gone from Shant Twitter to Seldom Twitter to, you know, I'm getting there, but I'm still not quite sure how it all works. I want to get to one quick thing before we go, just a couple minutes left. You know, I hate Black History Month. Not that I hate the month and honoring African-American heritage in history, but it seems like we in the media dump all of our stories about African-Americans in 28 days, sometimes 29 days of February. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, there's a lot of discussion within the African American community as to whether Black History Month has outlived its usefulness. But I'll say this. Any chance to hear news about history, about American history, to me is a valued opportunity. And especially when it's a history that has been so marginalized, I think it's worth hearing it. Mm-hmm. And I think you wish it was happening 12 months a year, but does that mean people are saying it's only, I just got a new book out, a Black History book. It's June, so I'm not going to do it because it's not February. No, that's not the way it works. Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, what happens is too much stuff comes out in February for everyone to actually think about and wrap their head around.
And consume, yeah.
But, I mean, better that than nothing.
But I guess my point is we should be doing it in January and March and April and
across
May.
Across the board.
And not just focus it all on. Because I think that's, I mean, human nature is, you know, we did that story in February. We don't need to do it again in May or April or whatever. And I think that's why I'm opposed. I'm also opposed to, I think it's March being lawnmower repair month as well. The whole awareness month thing bothers me. What's the future of diversity at NPR's coverage and how do you think it's – do you see yourself getting an assistant editor of diversity in the next
– Well, what I see is taking what I learned this past week and applying it in terms of social media aggressively to figure out where people are online, what they're saying, and how to get them on our air.
So that's the next frontier for making sure you get a diverse pool
of
sources.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that means you'll be Twittering more. Do you have a Twitter address yet?
I do. It's at Luis Clemens. That's at Luis Clemens, Clemens.
Okay. Thanks very much. Luis Clemens, he's the senior diversity editor for diversity at National Public Radio. Can we still say that? We can't say that anymore. It's NPR. He's at NPR. Thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be back tomorrow. My thanks to Amy Jurevich at the controls, Linda Taylor, and Jeff, who have been manning the phones and helping me produce this program. This is 89.7 WOSU, 89.7 WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News is a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.